Today's conference is now being recorded.
Thank you very much. Alan, I'll do a quick roll call. Good morning, good evening to everyone. On today's call, we have Alan Greenberg, Tatiana Kramsova, Sergei Gorbunov, Cheryl Langdon Orr, James Liddell, Mike O'Connor, Paul Diaz, Michael Pelage, Tim Ruiz, Mason Cole, Jeffrey Eckhouse, Michaeli Nalon, Elaine Doolin, Glenn McKnight. From staff, we have Marika Konings, Margie Milam, Gisela Gruber-White, myself, and apologies, we have William McKellicott, Karim Atumani. If I can also please remind everyone to state their names before they speak for transcript purposes. Thank you.
Thank you, Gisela. The first item on the agenda is the update from the data collection subteam. Since the data collection subteam is meeting tomorrow morning, I don't think there is anything substantive to report. Does anyone else on the group have any comments? That's Michael and James, if I remember correctly, plus staff.
Yes, Alan, this is James, and I was very confused to see that on the agenda since we are meeting tomorrow.
Well, the update for the group is we are meeting tomorrow, which had been kept a secret from the rest of the group until now. I don't think there's anything else to report on that.
Now, this is Mikey. You want to predict your result?
Since there'll be three people on the call, predicting results may be difficult. Each one of us independently could predict our own results. All right. The next item is review what further information or discussion is required to fulfill requirements of the charter. The first sub-item is to pursue the availability of further information from ICANN compliance staff. And we just had a document that came in from William today, which augments the study they did, the study they did earlier this year on a number of compliance issues. I gather William is not on the call. Is someone else from policy staff going to take us through those?
I just pulled up the email in the Adobe Connect. You know, I can't answer any specific questions on it, but I think basically overall, this is the email that William sent to the list is an audit that I think the results haven't been officially published yet, but I think they're supposed to be out shortly. But they reviewed whether registrars have a fee posted for recovery in RGP as is required under the EDDP posted on their website. And as he states, a large number of registrars, close to 500 of them, posted information on the website in relation to recovering domain names that are in RGP, which either did not mention fees or mentioned them but did not specify any amount. And he notes that compliance will be issuing an advisory and reaching out to registrars to make sure that they understand that the requirement is to post the actual fees charged to the registered name holders for recovering domain names that are in RGP. There was as well an exchange on the mailing list, I think, between Jeff and William on specific provisions. I don't know, Jeff, if you have any further questions or...
Yeah, I did. I actually had just one point. I know William's not on the call, so I'm not going to ask any questions directly.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I
can ask questions and I can take them back if you want.
This way we don't have to go through the list. The first one was, I guess this is just in general, when you were saying that he's going to post these and make them public, I was curious if they were going to go through, I don't know, maybe some of the other, like the methods of the audit, because I did have some questions there. So I don't know if that will be posted or if it's possible maybe to some of the, I guess, maybe not publicly, but to the registrars that were, you know, that were there, because some of them I'm a little confused about, because the statements in the RAA and the expired domains deletion policy states that this is for registrars that offer registration services through their website. So I wanted to make sure that, because there's a lot of registrars have credentials, including ourselves, where we don't offer registration services through the website, through that credential, but do have the ICANN requirements of the who is services and the agreements, but don't offer registration services through the site. So, of course, so then we don't have the RGP fees because we don't offer registration. So I wanted to make sure those were excluded and to see sort of the accounting of how the compliance, the audit was done.
Okay, I'll take that back to William and ask him to respond to the list with an answer to that question.
Oh, that would be great. Thank you.
This is Mike Village. Can I have a follow-up question?
Yes, Mike, go ahead.
William there. Thanks. Jeff, on with your interpretation of having, I believe your interpretation was not offering registration services through the website. Is that was your...
Well, yeah, no, my interpretation was actually just reading the document where it says if the registrar offers domain registration through the website, then it must post the fees on the website.
So let me ask you a question, and perhaps this is a point for further clarification, but let's just suppose there's a registrar who, reading that, says, well, I don't offer registrations through the website, but I provide an API for resellers. Would that then fall under your definition, or do you have an opinion on how other registrars might interpret that obligation on the resellers?
I don't have an opinion how other registrars would interpret, because I can only say how I would interpret it, but I know on ours, for Enom, we offer domain registrations also where we have the API, so we do comply on that area. Versus the only one I can discuss are what's under, you know, Enom and my purview, and there are ones that we do not offer registration services through that credential, and those are the ones where we don't post the fees because we don't offer any registrations, any prices for any domains there.
But do those registrar sponsor names?
No. They're used for domains in expiration for when domains become available.
It's Alan. I'm confused between the question Mike asked and the one Jeff answered. I thought Mike was asking essentially what happens in the case where a registrar does not sell domains directly but does through resellers, and
I can only say the opinion for myself, which is what we do, which is for Enom, we do offer there. We don't have a credential where we offer through resellers and not domain registrations through an API. So I can't answer that on what we do because we offer both in that piece. So, and I'm personally not sure there's any registrar that through their registrar credential offers domain services through an API only or exclusively and not through their website.
Well, there is at least one. Two Cows doesn't offer registrations directly other than through a sister company.
Okay, I mean, that's
moot in this particular case.
Right, exactly. I think that might be direct to them. I thought they do through a different retail brand, but under the same credential. But that's a question for Two Cows that I cannot answer.
Yeah, I don't know either. I think technically they're a reseller, but I don't know the corporate structure well enough to say that. And it's not really up to either of us to hypothesize on that.
This is Tim. I can tell you that WildWestDomains.com is a registrar that does not offer retail registrations, period. It works solely through resellers. However, the information is posted on the Wild West site. The situation may be that resellers mark that up. I guess would be the thing to consider. I can't tell you if that's true or not in that regard. But Wild West, what their price is actually posted there. And then, you know, just one other observation, which, you know, we may or may not want to consider, but just something I want to throw out, and that is that, you know, this issue of resellers has been coming up repeatedly. It came up here. It's coming up in the transfers working group. My concern is that clearly there's an issue about resellers and how these things are enforced. My question is, do we want to deal with them on this ad hoc basis individually within each CDP, or is this something that maybe should be set aside and dealt with on its own so that there's some sort of cohesive approach to how we deal with it and not, you know, an ad hoc conglomeration of different policies or recommendations or whatever that might come out of all these individual PDPs. Just a thought, something to consider.
Yeah, I guess my short answer to that, it's Alan, is that we're already dealing with it in an ad hoc basis because there were a number of specific explicit statements about resellers in the new RAA. And so we've already started down the line of dealing with it on a somewhat ad hoc basis. And the question is, do we want to continue that way until there is a more generalized policy, or do we want to discard any discussion of it until there's a generalized policy? This is the way I would phrase it, a little bit differently from what you said.
This is Mike Palage. I do think Tim, though, does raise perhaps a broader point that the council may want to address. You know, since this reseller issue is, this whack-a-mole is popping up in different PDPs that are currently ongoing. That being said, going back to the principle which I've been trying to articulate from the beginning about openness, transparency, and predictability for the end registrant, I think that those three factors apply, and our recommendation should apply regardless of whether it's a registrar or whether it's a reseller. So from that standpoint, I think our end recommendations really should be registrar/reseller neutral. We should be looking at protecting the interest of the registrants through this process.
That was certainly the intent of the original request for issues report we started this.
So Mike, just so you understand, there's one possibility then that we proceed. We may not be able to resolve the issue of how this stuff is enforced on resellers, but we proceed with the best course of action to protect the registrants, and then we look at, as a separate issue, how, in general, any of these things, whether it's this one or transfers or whatever, how they are dealt with in regards to registrars as a later issue.
Resellers, you mean?
I guess, Mike Palage speaking again for purposes of the transcriber. I guess what happens, Tim, is I would have to really go back. I've not yet had the time to really look at the new RRA in much depth. Perhaps, I don't know if Margie's on the phone, but, you know, perhaps she could talk about the flow-down requirements under the old and the new and whether that, you know, does potentially bifurcate an implementation or a solution. So, as I said, I think you are right that this reseller issue is a broader thing that probably does need to be addressed, but I don't want that to impede the work that is before us right now, which, as I said, I think is independent of registrars or resellers.
Mike, this is Margie, if I could reply. I can certainly look at the issue and work with our legal department to interpret what the contract says with respect to resellers. Can you, Mike, kind of repeat what the specific, you know, issue related to resellers is that you'd like to have clarity on?
Perhaps maybe Tim and I could talk offline and then send you an email so that there's clarity between Tim and I, and then there's no confusion when you forward that request to GC.
Okay.
I'd like to be involved in that too.
Okay.
Mike.
Sure.
Marika, there was an earlier report that is pointed to in your agenda that was published, I think, last February or March on compliance.
Correct. Let me just
now, that particular report said that of the 900 and some odd registrars, they were checking to see whether a policy is mentioned on the registrar's website. About 750 were not were compliant, and about 150 they were unable to determine, and there would be follow-up work with the registrars. Do we have any follow-up report on what the outcome of that evaluation was, which was supposed to take several weeks after the publication?
Yeah, as I stated in that email as well, this is Marika, the compliance team did some follow-up. I need to check with William if they have already exact numbers, but I think the idea is to repeat the audit at a certain point in time to see indeed if the number has gone down. But he already estimated that the number of non-compliant registrars had gone down 30 to 40% following the outreach that the compliance staff did in explaining the requirements under this provision.
So perhaps still 100 which were not compliant.
Yeah, I will follow up with William to see if he has any other numbers on this or further information as to when they might review this issue again.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions on the two compliance studies that we are talking about at the moment?
This is Marika. I mean, another question would be, of course, because the question here is pursuit availability of further information. The question is there any other information that this group feel they would need or would like to see from the compliance department in moving forward in addressing the charter questions?
Well, I think that's the core of what we'll be discussing at the meeting tomorrow, is it not? I mean, we're looking at information that we believe would be helpful, and that might be from compliance or might be from some other source.
Okay, yeah, that's more on the data gathering, but this might be more related to enforcement and how current REA provisions are enforced.
Well, excuse me, we've already asked for information on the number of complaints related to expiration, and I would hope that is going to be forthcoming in some form. That's a request we made at least two meetings ago, I think. I don't think there's anything else we've explicitly asked for since then. But anyone else remember something that we missed?
This is Mikey. Just to restate Marika's question, I don't know that that's what she was asking. I think really what she's asking is there anything else that we as a group might want? And, it may be useful to wait until the data collection meeting tomorrow, but it's certainly a valid question.
No, I don't disagree, but I was saying I think the only thing that we have already asked for was statistics on the complaints received as a matter of normal course and a breakdown on how many of them related to expiration. We did get a breakdown of how many related to transfers, but we don't know which of those were expiration transfers at expiration time or which ones were not related to transfers but related to expiration.
But I'm not sure, this is Marika again, I'm not sure whether that, I think William did say that information might not be available, we have to break down as is. I think Mikey was spot on. My question was related to the specific issue on, because I mean, I think some of the work that compliance has done in this area was, of course, inspired as well by the issues report and some of the questions raised there. So, one of the questions would be, are there any other items that you feel compliance should pursue or have a similar audit on that are current provisions under either the EDDP or the RAA that are required to inform this group in its further deliberations?
It's certainly a valid question. I don't know the answer, and we can, if you could, pass that question on. We're talking about other things that compliance can verify through websites and such. Tim?
Yeah, I was going to say, in regards to the complaints, whether they can or can't break down, whatever complaints statistics we do get, wouldn't we need to understand how they relate to the overall picture? So, I don't know if it would be, the number of expired domains per year or for the period that the complaints cover or something of that nature, so we can get some sort of idea of what we're talking about, the scope of the scope of it. Otherwise, the number is just a number. It doesn't really relate to anything.
I guess my feeling is those numbers would be nice to have, but since we have no idea what percentage of people who have a problem follow the complaint process, it doesn't really tell us the size of the underlying problem. Interesting numbers nonetheless, but I'm not sure it will really give us a substantive feel for how large the problem might be. Anything else? Excuse me, on point number one. Okay, in the absence of any comments, point number two of this item is to review the current domain name lifecycle with a pointer to Rob Hall's presentation. Marika, did you have any thoughts on how we do this? Do you want to try to review it or just...
No, the pointer was more related to that is the information we have, and the question for the group is there any further discussion or further information required to cover this item? So, I would be hesitant to try to cover Rob Howell's presentation, especially as it is recorded and the slides are on the site. I would, encourage everyone that hasn't done so yet to have a look there. But again, this is trying to go through the list of items that were outlined in the charter for the group to review before moving into discussion of the different charter questions. So it's an attempt of trying to see where we stand and whether there's further information required before we can move to those charter questions.
This is Mike Palage. Marika, I guess if you recall, I had sent previously to the list how different registries actually have a different change in billing cycle. Obviously, the Afilias and the VeriSign registry, those registries in which VeriSign and Afilias provide back-end registry infrastructures, those registries automatically debit at the expiration date, whereas the registries provided by Neustar as well as .cat, they wait until after the 45th day until they do a debiting. So I think Rob's presentation, while an incredibly good first step in the process, I think we may want to supplement that and show some of the different mutations or variations that take place. And then I think one of the other things that hopefully we'll find out through the survey that staff will be undertaking is, some of those other different practices. Are there registrars changing who is data, how that potentially impacts different things like that. So I think the presentation that Rob gave in Sydney was excellent. I found it very informative, but I think we may want to provide some further delineations and not just use a broad brushstroke to say this is what happens in all cases, because again, that would lead that's not the predictability that I think we're looking to get to on behalf of veteran registrants.
Michael, it's Alan. I have a question. Is there any evidence that you're aware of that says for any given registrar they follow different practices based on the different billing cycles? Because the billing cycle has impact on their finances and their cash flow, but it's not necessarily doesn't force them to present a different image to the end registrant.
As I said, I started with the GoDaddy website with the information I was able to glean from that as a GoDaddy customer myself. Have not stopped really going to any other registrars because there was, I think, the intent to allow staff to undertake that initiative in a more neutral fashion. So the simple answer is no, because I stopped when I stopped shortly after I started trying to ascertain.
The reason I'm asking is I don't think I want to, we want to spend a lot of time pursuing a particular line if there's no real difference presented to the registrar regardless of the financial model. If any of the registrars have any comments, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, Alan, Jeff, this is James.
Oh, go ahead, James.
Oh, sorry, Jeffrey. I just wanted to point out that before we were to modify or alter any of the life cycles as described by Rob, that perhaps that we could form that into a question, you know, for Rob or the other registrars, as opposed to just modifying that that life cycle.
Well, the question I was asking is, at least anecdotally for the registrars we have now, is there really any difference in the life cycle depending on the different billing cycles or billing methodology of the registry?
And if I'm not mistaken, Mike, the ones that you're describing are, a lot of them are sponsored TLDs, so like travel and...
No. As I said, right now, it actually depends on who your infrastructure provider is, because Afilias, VeriSign, and Neustar that provide registry infrastructure services have their software hard-coded. So, for example, .biz, which is an unsponsor, reacts just the same from a billing cycle as .tel and .travel, which are both sponsored. But that is different from the way the Afilias and VeriSign registry infrastructure works. And again, it's not a sponsored, unsponsored. It really depends on who your infrastructure provider is, how the billing cycle takes place. Now, again, I think Rob's, to date, most of the discussion has generally centered on .com, because right now, obviously, that's potentially one of the more lucrative ones in the secondary market. But again, sounding like a broken record, openness, transparency, and predictability on behalf of the registrants, what is this going to look like when we potentially have 500 new TLDs or 1,000? You know, I don't know what an OSS registry does. I have not yet looked into it. But I think these are real technical differences that impact, it definitely impacts a registrar's business model and their bank account. And I don't know yet if that has an impact on how a registrant goes about recovering their name. So it's just a question that I'm asking.
And I was asking for the small sample of registrars we have here. Do you know the answer to that?
Yeah, Alan, it's Jeff here. Can,
sure.
Can I respond?
Yes,
so
please.
I want to actually try and maybe actually tie both of your questions into hopefully one response. And the point being that, Mike, that as you stated, there are different models, and I understand what you're saying between Neustar and the other piece. And I think, and Alan, to your question is, as of now, since VeriSign and Afilias and the ones who debit right away comprise probably about 98% of registrations, and how it works, that let's call it somewhere, I don't know, you know, for Enom what it is, but I think in general it's somewhere between, somewhere above 95%, that we do not change our model because of that small segment of that 1 or 2%. So we do not change it based upon that. We keep it the same for all the TLDs that we manage. We don't change it based upon that expiration. And that's because we're not going to change it for a small slice of a certain TLD and make it even more, you know, make it confusing to certain customers, saying if you have a Neustar one, then it's going to work this way versus if you have a .com, it's going to work another way. So everything, we keep it uniform. And as I said, one, it's for the convenience of the customer. Two, we're not going to change our system for a registry or infrastructure provider that represents, you know, less than probably 3% of the domain registration.
I would think to reduce minimize confusion of your own staff also.
Alan, this is Mason.
Yes, go ahead.
So I would agree with Jeff in terms of operations on our registrars. Really, I'm lockstep with Jeff on that. It's not at all worth the headache of trying to explain to a customer the finer gradations of operational changes. They're not in a position to understand it, and we're not in a position to try to orient our systems to try to make, you know, very fine changes based on those on a very small slice of the marketplace. So it's much easier for us and for our customers if we just present sort of a united front across the board on all TLDs.
Okay, thank you, Mason. Tatiana, you have your hand up.
Yeah. And I'm a representative for RU Center, Russian Registrar, and we don't differ different registries. It's our system too. So we have the uniform system for all the GTLD and CTLD domains. not based on any billing procedures.
Okay, thank you, Tatiana. Tim, did you have any comment on GoDaddy, or do you want to ask why?
This is James.
Yes.
Yes, I just confirmed that we do the same.
Okay.
And this is Paul for Network Solutions. We're the same as the other registrars.
Okay, we'll take all that into account when we have our meeting tomorrow. Any other discussion right now on the life cycle process?
It's Jeff here. I have one other point. I don't want to get sort of, I guess there are some points on there that in Rob's presentation that I think that were Rob's interpretation and maybe Momentous or his companies and some of the figures in there and some of the analysis of, and I guess even some of the conclusions by saying, towards the end, saying so things about how much, what it is, the thresholds that certain registrars use and that, some of the claims that, where was it? Oh, that's saying, hey, no domains of value go through, but that everyone has their own interpretation of what value is, and some of those terms I think, if we're going to use this as a what happens in the life cycle to sort of take out these terms that are I don't say pejorative or influential, but sort of just stick to certain facts versus some of the claims that are in there. If we're going to use this in the working group as sort of a statement of fact, and the other piece on that is, I'm just going to say it to the group, but it's mentioned towards Paul and Network Solutions, is that there were some claims in there for Network Solutions that I think that have changed since then. So you might want to take a look at the presentation for what happens in the domain lifecycle. So this way it stays current.
Yes, thank you, Jeff. This is Paul, and both the presentation you did and then the transcript we're going over right now, in fact, because there are some things that have been changed in time.
Okay.
This is Mike Pelage, and I think if we are on a fact-finding mission here, would it not be important to document those changes to see kind of where the changes are, where they're happening? So if we're just looking at the snapshot today and not what it was, say, 6 months ago, I think we need to look at that, because if there are beginning to develop best practices or recommendations that might help increase the predictability for the end registrant, I think that would be very important to document in our end report.
Certainly.
Can I be in a queue?
Yes, in a moment. As soon as I get one sentence out. I think anything that any of the registrars in this working group can contribute to give us examples of what happens, I think that will be of significant benefit, and I suspect that's one of the things coming out tomorrow. Marika?
Question, Alan. Should we send that to you or to Marika to collect that? I guess, Marika, you'll probably hopefully respond to that now.
Yeah, because my proposal was, or I presume this group would like to document the domain name lifecycle as well in their report. So my suggestion would be to try to transcribe Rob's explanation in a more neutral way, and of course this group then will have an opportunity to review all the statements and all any missing information that is in there, so it can be presented in a neutral, accurate, and up-to-date fashion. So it's more, I think that the reference here to Rob's presentation is more for the understanding of this group, and absolutely, I'm sure there are nuances or things that are his view or from his perspective, but I think it would probably be good for the report as well to have a description of the domain name lifecycle that is supported by the group and has all the elements that everyone feels comfortable with.
I support that, and I would go a little bit further. And one of the things I got out of Rob's presentation, and I'm excluding the specific hard examples of the examples he gives towards the end, but one of the things I got out of it is there's large variation among registrars, and in terms of the registrant's experience, it's highly dependent on the individual practice of the registrar, and as a few people have pointed out in this call, even for any given registrar, it changes over time. So I think one of the important things to come out with is not necessarily to say what a specific registrar does, although that may be interesting, but to try to give the range of business practices among a large group of registrars. In terms of the question of who to send it to, unless you feel there's something proprietary that you wouldn't want to send to the list, I would send it to the whole list.
Yeah, I assumed if I was going to send it to Marika or to you, Alan, that it would be I'd send it to everyone so that it would be posted to the list. And I agree with you completely that there is the thing I got out of it is that there are some big variations of different registrars, and I think that would be great if we could post the different variations of what goes on. I think that would be helpful.
To quote Mike Belage, of what we want is both transparency and clarity for the registrant, and that I think should be one of the outcomes of this working group, is to try to make sure that when we finish, we have that amount of clarity and transparency.
Fully agree.
Any other comments on the lifecycle presentation? So to summarize, we are soliciting now, but probably will out of the data collection meeting tomorrow. We'll be soliciting information on the range of experiences that registrants have, and then trying to summarize them in some neutral way, omitting statements which may not be statistically valid, such as no domains of value ever go into the redemption grace period or things like that. Clearly, we're not in a position to say no, but we can try to understand what a moderately large group of registrars does. All right, the next item, which I think we've already started talking about, was review current registrar practices regarding domain name expiration, renewal, and post-expiration recovery. I think, in fact, I'm not sure there's a need to have more discussion on this particular call on that, in that we've already said we are asking those registrars present to give us whatever information they can, and we will probably be soliciting more based on the data collection subteam. Is that a reasonable statement? Is that an unreasonable statement? Is there anyone still here?
You have posed a bit of a logic problem.
All right, you're saying it's the chairman's call whether it's reasonable or unreasonable.
This is Mikey. Yeah,
let's
carry on.
Alan, this is James.
Hey.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that it may be difficult to get all historical revisions of practices over time, especially when some of them may have occurred within the context of different policies on this that govern the life cycle. So I think that, you know, getting what we can. I think would be reasonable, and you know, getting everything that we've ever done, I think, is probably less reasonable.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but most registrant agreements say that as the registrar changes the rules, they change implicitly, typically without notice. So do we really need to look at anything other than the current ones?
I think that's probably a more reasonable approach.
I mean, there may well be some registrant agreements which say the rules in force when you signed the original agreement stay in force. I haven't seen one of those.
No, and we don't keep millions of revisions in effect at, you know, all times. So I think just logistically that's correct.
The statement has often made that registrars and registries are the only ones to sign agreements which can change, but in fact every registrant typically does.
Well, and I was speaking more of just internal practices, okay?
Yeah, no,
regardless of whether they're reflected in the agreement, the internal practices change. I don't know that they change all that frequently, but if they changed based on some internal or external context that has also changed, you know, it would be very difficult to gather those going back.
Is there anyone on this call that feels we need historical views?
This is Mason. No, I don't know if that would necessarily be helpful. I mean, if you're trying to address the situation as it exists today, then no, it looks like current, whatever's happening currently would be the thing to examine.
This is Mike Palage, and not to sound like an attorney, but it depends. And let me explain why I think it depends. Is if we find that there were certain practices that was negatively impacting the registrants, and the industry voluntarily have abandoned those practices, right, which it would be a good thing, right, we may want to document those bad practices as a way of prohibiting some new actor from transgressing or going back to something. So, I don't think we should spend a lot of time, but if in the course of our research we have some anecdotal evidence where registrants were harmed by a specific practice, we may want to document that practice and perhaps in our recommendation say, you know, this should not be done. So, you know, I just offer that as a basis for why we may not want to discard that.
You're saying we could consider such things if they come up, but we're not actively soliciting past histories from registrars.
I would say that. Okay. I think that's a fair assessment. Again, we have a narrow I think we have a narrow timeline to get this work done. So going on a fishing expedition, I don't think is in anyone's best interest.
We have unanimity. I think we need to stop talking about it before we change. Okay. Excuse me. I just came off of 35 hours of flying, and my throat is still a little bit dry. Okay, the next item we had, if time allows, and time is certainly allowing at this point, to actually start looking at the charter question, of the charter questions with number one, whether adequate opportunity exists for registrants to redeem their expired domain names. Again, I think part of this is going to come out of the information we are seeking in the data collection subgroup. And part of it, was presented by Rob in the expiration life cycle, saying that it is certainly possible that virtually no time exists at all based on the registrar practice. If a domain is particularly interesting, it could get auctioned or sold almost immediately after expiration. How do people want to go about trying to address this question in a more formal sense?
Alan, this is James.
Yeah.
Before we dive too deeply into this, I think that we probably should have an understanding of what is adequate. You know, is that a measure of time? Is that a measure of, I know one of the other charter questions discusses frequency of notification. But I think that, you know, we should probably get on the same page relative to what's adequate. I mean, GoDaddy has 12 days. Is that adequate? Someone who's used to dealing with a registrar that provides less time, that would probably seem more than adequate. So, you know, I think that we should probably get synchronized as to what adequate means.
Well, I think adequate time, we need to define adequate time, or we need to come to closure on what the group believes is adequate time, and we also need to come to closure on what we believe is adequate notice. In other words, a domain which expires, but how the website behaves, how the domain name behaves, does not change. Is that adequate notice, for instance?
Well, I think, is notice covered? And I don't have the charter questions in front of me, I apologize, but I thought that notice was covered with one of the other charter questions. Notifications. Is that correct?
I think they cross over. Marika, you wrote it, so you may give us your opinion of it. I would think opportunity implies two parts. The one, you have to know that something exists, and then do you have the ability to do anything about it.
Okay, and then adequate could mean more than just time frame. For example, if GoDaddy allows you to come in and renew it as if you were prior to the expiration date, versus we could conceivably design a process that would call folks to contact support and fax in all kinds of documentation, and you know that's you know I'm trying to understand what's meant by adequate.
Marika.
Yeah, in response to that question, I mean, there are two different questions in the charter, one that indeed speaks about the notices and if there's sufficient notice provided to registrants when their domain name expires. And I mean, in my interpretation, but as my personal interpretation, this was related indeed to this question one. It's related to the opportunity to recover names after they have expired and not specifically linked to notices received. Because there's as well another question on what should happen when a domain name has expired, you know, is it sufficient? What is the current practice, or should there be other measures in place? So, of course, all these questions in the end are related, and you know, I think the idea would be that an overall policy or recommendations come back that address all these issues in one coherent policy or best practice or whatever comes out. So, I think it's unavoidable that those questions will be taken together in times, but it might be helpful to look at them one by one and then try to bring them all together. But again, I mean, the group might prefer a different approach and throw it all in one pile and try to do everything at the same time.
Yeah, I just think they are so closely linked that I'm not sure how we can completely separate them.
You got hands up, Alan.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Tim.
Jeff can go first.
Oh, okay. I had one question, Tim.
You just mentioned, you said, I just wanted to make sure I heard what you said, that you said that domains that have value do not enter the expiration period. Is that something you stated?
The redemption period is one of the things that Rob said.
Oh, the redemption period, not the, so there is time, so you're saying that they do go through, they do flow through the, so the person doesn't renew, it flows through the expiration period, whatever that time may be.
My understanding of the current rules and from what Rob said, the practices, is that a registrar, if the registrar has terms in their contract which says they can transfer the ownership immediately upon expiration, then indeed they can do that, and they can sell or auction that domain immediately with virtually no time between the moment of expiration and the time the domain is transferred to someone irrevocably.
Right. So
I'm not saying that happens every day, but I believe the current rules allow that to happen.
Right. So I just want to be the difference, though, because there were two different things stated there. So you're saying, but I don't think one leads into the other, which is stating that if that provision is in there, then the previous registrant does not have a chance to renew. Because these terms are being thrown out. I just want to make sure that there's evidence in saying here's specific cases or here's people that specifically do that, saying the registrar has the right to transfer ownership, and then this registrar that does that does not offer a chance for the previous registrant to renew the domain. Because it's being thrown out that these happen. I'd love to see evidence of this or just stating that versus people claiming that it does happen, if it's possible that we can show this.
Whether we can find examples or not, I would be hesitant to allow rules to go forward which allow a registrar to change their internal practices and allow that to happen, even if we don't have cases of it happening today.
I'm sorry, Mason, with a question. I'm sorry, there are hands
sorry.
Raised ahead
we've
of me. So
we've got a line up first.
Yeah, okay. I'll raise my hand, sorry.
Tim first.
Yeah, I'm going to put my hand down and I'll just wait for others here.
McKaylee?
Sorry, I was just taking myself off mute. There's been a lot of backwards and forwards about things, and some of it's, I can see, going to be a bit controversial. Just coming back to two things regarding notifications. One area that we've seen has been a source of confusion is in relation to American, North American-based registrars, who use American date formats in notifications. Now, this may seem like a silly problem, but for Europeans, that can cause confusion. So, something which it might be worth looking at, is that a source of confusion that people think that domains aren't going to expire when they've already expired because the date format in the notifications that they receive is ambiguous. It doesn't state clearly this is American date format or anything along those lines. And the other one, which I think might upset a couple of my colleagues in the registrar constituency, but I've been asked to raise this, is one of the issues that we've seen happen regarding our clients. I'm not going to get into registrants and shoppers and all that, but just refer to people who actually pay us money, is because of the way some domains never fully expire, in that they're picked up again by somebody else without actually going to a full deletion process, that there's a problem arises that when somebody does a whois lookup on the domain, it still appears that it never actually was recreated, if you follow me. In other words, the domain might have been registered in 1999, it expired with registrar A in 2007, was picked up by registrar B or an affiliate A. As this causes a bit of confusion for end users.
That is, in fact, the norm right now, I believe.
Yeah, and it is a bit problematic and confusing. Just throwing that out there, and I'll now step back into the quietness again.
Anyone else with a hand up?
I'm trying to put my hand up, but I'm not successful here, so can I just jump in when available?
Just jump in.
All right, this is Mason. So I wanted to revisit James's question about adequacy, whether or not there's adequate opportunity for a name to be. I think the charter question says, if I'm not mistaken, adequate opportunity to recover a name post expiry. Is that right, or is it an adequate opportunity to renew the name at any point?
It says to redeem their expired domain names.
Okay. All right. So I do wonder if it would be useful to define the process by which registrants are obligated to maintain accurate whois data, including their contact information, for the purpose of the registrar fulfilling their obligation to notify of an upcoming expiration, and to document, if possible, the level of effort put forth by a registrar to remind the registrant that a name is approaching expiration before we consider what happens, not before, but as we consider what happens to a name post-expiry. Because I can only speak for my own registrar, but we send out at least 17 notices both prior and following expiration. And I can't speak for all registrars, but I would bet that most registrars have at least a double-digit number of reminders that go out to registrants. So, you know, I do want to make sure that we consider this entire process in its totality before we make assumptions about what registrars may or may not be motivated to do post-expiration. Now, I wanted also to say that with regard to immediately making a name available at auction, you know, the day after expiration happens, I'm not aware of any registrar that does it. That doesn't mean there aren't any that do, but I mean, I think that would be foolish for registrars to do for the reasons that I've stated before, which is registrars spend an awful lot of resource trying to get relationships with customers, and to sacrifice a relationship on the basis of a one-time transaction on a name is not very smart, and I'm not aware of very many who do that. So if we're considering making rules governing behavior post-expiration, I want to make sure that we don't do it on the basis of something that's not shown to be a problem. And if registrars aren't doing what it's feared they may be doing, then asking the entire lot to conform to a policy that's unnecessary, I think, may not be a good use of our time.
On the other hand, asking registrars to comply with
process they already follow is not particularly onerous.
I don't follow that. I'm sorry. What do you mean?
If we to be devil's advocate, end up with a policy saying you must allow at least 15 days during which the registrar can redeem their name before it is irrevocably sold or transferred to someone else, and you already do that, it doesn't have to alter your practices.
I get where you're coming from, but I think that no matter what rules or policies are put forth to registrars, I think it's only fair that the impact on registrar resources be considered.
Indeed.
Because you know, even I think assumptions are made, and I'm talking about the broader community. And now I am speaking for all registrars. I think assumptions are made that even small technical changes in processes are easy to implement or don't have an impact on resources, when in fact they do. And to, you know, to sort of lay all that work at the registrar's feet, I think it's easy for those who don't have to absorb the impact to minimize the idea that it is impactful. So I want a fair-minded approach when it comes to policy development that registrars alone are required to implement.
Paul, your hand up.
Yes, Paul Diaz, Network Solutions. Just to follow on what Mason's saying and actually to highlight something that you offered, Alan, let's also remember that in these grace periods, some of them are they're not all required. And so, you know, using your example when you said, well, for the registrars that are already doing things that might be considered a best business practice, it would be onerous if this working group were to say you must wait at least 15 days. Let's not forget that those grace periods are not obligations. They are there.
I would point out that you're correct. They are not obligations, which is why this policy development process is going on, that this group may choose to make them required process or required delays. And that's one of the potential outcomes of this whole process, to say that the rules in place today are not adequate.
Yeah, this is Tim. I'd like to get in the queue with now.
Yeah, James is there first, and then Tim.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think that this is James, and I think that Paul is absolutely correct, as well as Mason. You know, we have to be very careful with policy. If I'm a small registrar, maybe I can't afford with these registries the pre-bill expirations. Maybe I can't afford to carry a name for 13 days or whatever the number is. So I think that to say that certain things are because most people are doing them are transparent and have no impact other than what Mason described as resource impacts. I mean, they could have other impacts down the road, and I think that's why we need to understand the problem and understand if the consequence, you know, the cure is worse than the disease.
Tim?
Yeah, I think that my concern, Alan, with what you're proposing or suggesting is just that if we approach policy that way, then you know, we could have numerous policy processes going on for all kinds of things, and I don't think that's really where we want to end up. You know, let's do a policy that, you know, 80-90% of the registrars are already doing, but let's put a policy in place to make everybody else do it. I think the point is that if the, you know, if the market is competitive and registrants have choice, that should come into play when we consider policy. And I think that it's important that we have some sort of data to back up policy when we do implement it. So that's why I guess I was proposing that we try to understand the relationship of the complaints to, you know, the overall activity, simply because if we find through this process that registrars that represent, you know, 90 plus some odd percent of the registrations are already providing adequate opportunity, or that the complaints are some minute fraction of a percent of the overall domains that expire, I mean, I just think it's going to be difficult to support, you know, any significant policy that's going to affect, you know, such a small number, and that could be resolved through just selecting one of the plethora of other registrars who are already providing adequate opportunity. So that may or may not be the result of all this, but I think that has to be considered, and that policy that takes away registrars' ability to differentiate themselves in different areas would be a disadvantage to the market overall. So we don't want to hurt competition. We want to continue to encourage it.
Just out of curiosity, would you consider that not changing what the registrars can do, but ensuring that they make it blatantly clear what they are planning to do, not necessarily buried 14 pages down in a contract, is reasonable? Again, I'm not suggesting that's the outcome.
I mean, we'd have to look at what's reasonable. You know, are we going to require registrars to do things that the rest of the every other segment of the industry isn't required to do? And if we are, then why? You know, this has been an ongoing debate over software contracts, shrink wrap software contracts, whatever, all kinds of things for a long time. There really isn't, you know, any easy solution to all of that without, you know, taking away a business's ability to actually make decisions about what's best and how to best market.
Let's not try to decide the outcome right now.
Right, right. So I'm just saying, though, that it's a broader issue than just, you know, what should registrars do?
Yeah, if I could get in the queue as well.
Go ahead. Pelage in the queue after Mason, please.
So, thanks, Mike. I have to agree at least some with what Tim says. I think I don't necessarily disagree with the idea that registrars need to be well informed about what could happen with their names. If you look at the totality of things that registrars or anyone who enters into a customer provider relationship, a contractual relationship, if you look at anything that's required to be disclosed, you have a pretty long document to start with, and I think we can thank all the attorneys for that. So I think, you know, if we take one section of an agreement and we say it needs to be more blatantly displayed, then, you know, I think there's the opportunity for the next organization with an issue of interest to come along and say, well, if you're making that known, then we want our issue known and more blatantly displayed as well. And the next thing you know, you've got, I don't know how that would be done. You know, if one particular section of an agreement is more excised out of the agreement and presented to a registrant before a transaction is even made, or I don't know how that would be done. I can see a scenario as an alternative where registrars would cooperate in some kind of education effort to make registrants better informed about the intricacies of the marketplace without violating their whatever their antitrust issues might be. But, you know, Tim is correct. At some point, I can't set up a layer of registrars intentionally to introduce competition and innovation into the marketplace. And registrars are expected to go and fulfill that mission. And now that they have, you know, there are some understandable complaints about some of the things that may have happened. But we have to be careful about how we constrain registrars' ability to differentiate themselves. Yeah, I just want to make sure that's understood.
Mike?
This is Mike Pelage. I fully agree with Tim's statement about differentiation in the marketplace. The only caveat I would say is that while generally differentiation is a good thing, there needs to be a caveat, however, when differentiation potentially harms a registrant or a third party, and I think that's what we're trying to look at here. And to get back to the point that I believe Michael on Michael Nealand had raised previously about domains which are quote-unquote expired and transferred to a third party, but in which the registration date, the original registration date, stays the same. This practice potentially has the ability to negatively impact trademark owners in bringing a UDRP action, because one of the things that the trademark one of the defenses is registration prior to a trademark owner's acquisition of rights. Now, for all practical purposes, we have heard that registrars will treat this as a deleted name and their services reassign this or reallocate it to a third party. Yet we're still seeing the same original registrant with the original party. And when you begin to impact third-party rights such as IP owners, I think that this is something that needs to be looked at in the broader context.
If I can join in the queue.
That's Mason.
Yep, thank you.
I think you're next.
Okay, so I think if there, again, I come back to the question, if there is existing evidence that can be pointed to say these harms are happening because of current praxis and they're evidenced as such, then we should take a look at them. If we're looking at instances that might happen, but certainly are not happening and haven't happened over the course of some reasonable amount of time, then I think we need to concentrate our resources where there actually may be a problem.
Anyone else want to address this right now?
That was a very loud sigh from me, Alan. Sorry, I'm looking at...
Would you like to actually say some words, not just sigh on the chat?
No. not at this point. I'm just looking back at the mutual benefits again from the results for both registrants and the domain name industry in Australia from a group of best practice agreements that were bludgeoned out of a joint process. And I think whilst it is painful, it's certainly well worth it, but we can vacillate for a rather long time on the shame of the proof, and I'm sorry I've only got anecdotal information, but that tends to stop us moving forward, and I'm really rather keen to move forward.
Yeah, I really would like to focus on the fact that, in general, I would not expect the bad actor registrars to be participating in this process. So it's not very surprising that the registrars who are here can, claim that their practices are reasonable, and I'm not questioning that. The question I'm asking the group is, how do we come up with hard evidence and numbers in the absence of anyone collecting any statistics on this kind of information? Either ICANN or the registrar's producing any, or the registrar's constituency. I'm not sure how we come up with the kind of evidence that is being requested by the registrars on this call.
Well, if I can speak to that, Alan, if I may. So speaking as chair of the constituency, I would say that, unfortunately, I mean, in any industry, you're always going to have bad actors, and you're right. They're going to hide under the rocks, and they're not going to participate. And as a constituency, we don't want we don't want bad actors in our midst any more than you do. Of course, the participants in ICANN processes and constituencies, on balance, you're going to find are the good actors.
Sure.
So I agree with you there. In terms of how we actually root the information out, I don't know. As chair, I'm not going to be able to compel a bad actor, if one is known, to come forth and say, well, yeah, I'm a bad actor, and here's what I do, and here's what you ought to do about it.
Or to verify that the information they're giving you is correct.
Yeah. So I can tell you in general that registrars usually hear of bad actors, and if they're known, then sometimes we can lean on them a bit and get them to change their way so that they don't end up painting all of us with the same black brush. And in the past, those kinds of things have been successful. So I'm not trying to be difficult over the issue. I do believe that if evidence is not readily available, then there may not be a problem. That's not to say that a potential problem may not develop down the line, but I don't think ICANN is in the business of preventing every possible problem that could occur from occurring. So, I'm happy to lend the constituency's efforts to a reasonable degree to finding out if there is a problem. But if we search and search and search and search and don't find anything beyond the anecdotal, then my concern is that's a lot of wasted effort.
I will point out that although there may be some people who want every problem to be fixed, every potential problem to be fixed, very, very few of them get to the stage of actually having a PDP in process. And so we're not talking about every possible problem that someone might...
No, I know. I appreciate that, but I mean, I'm being... I'm being I'm being illustrative.
I understand.
Yeah, but by trying to say that, you know, we're not in, ICANN is not in that kind of business.
But we've probably only had a half dozen or less PDPs in the history of ICANN related to registrar rules. So we're dealing with a very small subset, so I don't think we want to generalize too much. Okay, we have some other hands up. I'm not sure who had their hand up first, Jeff or James.
I think it was me, and I just want to, put it up before Mason spoke. One of the things is that, just Alan, to answer your question about collecting data, is as much as the registrar constituency would love to help, just as myself, I'm right now the treasurer, and I've tried to collect funds and solicit memberships from some of these guys that, you know, that are bad actors, because we want them involved so we can actually speak to them and tell them to change their ways. They don't respond. They don't respond to us. We have customers, as a registrar, we have customers that have issues with them. They don't respond to us either. So as much as we'd love to help, I think the data you'd get from the registrar constituency, which we'd love to, you know, from the people who are participants, would show you the data that, you know, I guess that people are complying, and the ones you're looking at are the bad actors. So I don't think it would be through the registrar constituency would be the right avenue, and it wouldn't be from, as you can imagine, just sending it out to any list to see. It would have to go through, probably my guess would be ICANN, but then I'm not even sure if they know which are those bad actors or bad people unless they have verified that the complaints are
You don't
bad.
Have to stress the case. I believe you 100%.
Yeah.
I think
I'm just trying to think of a way to collect the data. I'm trying to brainstorm on this. I think that's a major issue. I don't know how we do it.
Yeah. Thank you. James?
Well, just to continue to belabor the point, I mean, from transfers to security issues, registrars cannot get cooperation from the bad actor registrars as well. So,
and I think that's why we're in this PDP to begin with. Cheryl?
To belabor the point further, but that I would like to say a measurable thing, not a piece of anecdotal information, in terms of the bad actors, one of the extraordinarily useful tools we found within the CCTLD processes that we went through here in Australia is that with the knowledge that a registrar or reseller who says, here is the industry code of practice on their site, and it's enforceable by UDA, by the way, is a simple check that a registrant can use to say white hat, black hat potential. It's part of the education process.
McKaylee?
Sorry, just getting off mute again. Just two things. I mean, I would agree with Jeff that, you know, you're going to have a problem that with bad actors. I mean, over here in Ireland, we've had lots of fun trying to persuade companies to get involved with self-regulation. And you'll find that if there are 40 or 50 companies that provide a particular set of services that should be self-regulated, only a handful will actually opt in for the self-regulation. In terms of the gathering of evidence, the call for public comments has been picked up by quite a few of the domainer blogs and forums and things like that. And I posted, I think, one or two links to the list where people were discussing some of the things that they weren't actually submitting through the public comment channel. So I mean, maybe people have spent a bit of time having a look at what people were saying in comments on blogs where they mightn't get round to actually submitting a formal comment. It might be helpful.
Yeah, and I would agree. And on the user side, get the message out that there is a public comment period open. Is there anyone else who wants to speak to this? We have James.
Yeah, just very quickly, I'm wondering what role the ALAC can play in terms of an outreach and an educational tool or channel to help registrants become better educated about not only how the process works and how the life cycle works, but you know, perhaps which you know, who the bad guy registrars are. You know, I think we can do that, but you know, registrars it will always come in the form of marketing. And perhaps as a public service, some of this information could be disseminated through through some of the other organizations within ICANN. And it is that occurring.
If you'd like to supply the ALAC with a list of the bad actor registrars, we'll be happy to distribute it further.
Now, Alan, sorry, I'm taking my chair of the ALAC hat and putting it firmly on my head and responding now to Cheryl here. In fact, our at-large structures, which are out there working at the edges, many of them in general consumer advocacy and consumer information and education roles, both in and far beyond telco and communication and internet industries, let alone the subsets of domain industries, use that as their daily bread. It's what they do, and they are in a perfect position to work hand in glove with the supply side of this equation and do that effectively, and with an established trust relationship between the registrar / consumer and the person who's giving them or the group that's giving them the information source. So absolutely, it's why we need to be working much closer regionally, locally, within CC and within the GSA.
Okay, I'm picturing an ALAC approved seal of approval that we could proudly display.
I'm not sure the rest of us. I'm not sure I can properly agree of that.
I think we're heading into murky areas of costs of compliance and maintenance of marks. But from my personal perspective, I actually think recognisable marks are very useful. Within the Australian perspective, we found the cost of compliance and maintenance of a best practice mark was not worth the effort for an industry self-regulatory approach. What was worth the effort is educating consumers to say you are safer with a registry than you are with a reseller, unless the reseller links you to the following vital pieces of consumer information. Beware, be careful, and here are some websites that give you choices and links. And Oz Registry, you go to Oz Registry, any potential registrant, there is a random rolling selection of who is on the top of the list, but there is an open list of every accredited registrar, and we encourage them to have their resellers, where possible, port in the trickle down of the industry best practice, and people can certainly claim to be under industry best practice, and AUDA does relate that along with our ACCC, our trade regulator.
Yeah. I'll point out that we're embarking in parallel with this effort with the Charter of Registrant Rights and Responsibilities, which the new RAA will require registrars to point to. Now, it's not clear how this group is going to make clear statements about things which vary from registrar to registrar, such as the exact process of what happens at the end of expiration, but the challenge for that group is indeed to try to make it clear enough that registrants cannot say they didn't understand if they chose to at least look at this. So that process is going on in parallel, which may address some of what we're talking about here. Michaela, you had your hand up.
No, just echoing a bit of what Cheryl was saying. Cheryl was talking about the Australian market. I can only speak about the Irish market. The IE Domain Registry publishes a list of its authorised resellers, which actually splits into two groups, those of us with more than 500 registrations and those with, I think it's more than 50, but less than 500. And the list is displayed randomly, in random order. And if the company is not listed there, well, then they're not authorized to sell. Unfortunately, though, there's no real kind of best practice or anything like that. So apart from just providing the list, they're not really doing anything. URID did introduce a code of conduct, which was optional for registrars to sign up to. So I'm not very clear on the level of success that's had. Maybe some of the other registrars on the call might have more experience of it.
All right, we've got about 7 minutes left. I want a few minutes to talk about future meetings. Is there anything else that anyone wants to address right now? There are no hands up in the chat room right now. Nope. All right. We decided at the last meeting to schedule meetings on a weekly basis. I notice on the GNSO calendar they are not. There is one scheduled for next week, but after that they're set as biweekly again. And I would ask, I don't know if Gisela is still on the call or Marika, to make sure that the calendar reflects that they are, in fact, weekly meetings.
I'm here, and I'll do that straight away.
Thank you. Other than that, we've had an interesting discussion. I'm still not quite sure of how we go forward and start the substantive work of deciding what, if anything, we start to look at regarding policy. We do have a commitment to have something in the Seoul meeting, which is something like 6 weeks away right now. But I think we'll go on in this process for another couple of weeks and see where we get with it. Any comments? Go ahead.
I won't be available next week.
That's unfortunate.
I think I'm in.
This is Tim Allen. I won't be available either.
You've got a much better reason, Tim, though.
Yeah, but big vacation.
We don't accept vacations in this.
If it didn't involve my wedding anniversary, I might try to still participate, but my marriage comes first, I think.
Enjoy yourself, then.
Smart man, Tim.
In the absence of everyone saying they're not going to be here, we will hold a meeting next week. Hopefully we'll make some additional progress. Is there anything else we want to cover, or should we actually adjourn early? In the absence of any hands or comments, I thank you all for your participation.
Thank you.
Thanks, Alan.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Alan.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Okay.